Welcome to Season 8 of EdTech Insiders, where we speak to educators, founders, investors, thought leaders, and the industry experts who are shaping the global education technology industry. Every week, we bring you the week in EdTech, important updates from the EdTech field, including news about core technologies and issues we know will influence the sector, like artificial intelligence, extended reality, education politics, and more. We also conduct in-depth interviews with a wide variety of EdTech thought leaders and bring you insights and conversations from EdTech conferences all around the world. Remember to subscribe, follow, and tell your EdTech friends about the podcast and to check out the EdTech Insiders Substack newsletter. Thanks for being part of the EdTech Insiders community. Enjoy the show. Welcome to a special episode of EdTech Insiders. We're going to have a debate today between two EdTech founders and CEOs about the pedagogy of online learning and artificial intelligence. Joining us are two amazing guests, the visionaries behind Critique and MindJoy, two EdTech platforms that are redefining educational engagement and personalized learning. Karin Moret is the co-founder and co-CEO of Critique, an online peer-to-peer interactive learning platform designed for professors to engage students in a 21st century way. Through a gamified experience, Critique allows students to develop higher-order thinking skills, from creating assignments to analyzing and evaluating peer submissions. In addition, students develop skills necessary to deliver feedback to their peers through our Feedback on Feedback system. They're using AI and artificial intelligence to increase the reliability of peer assessment and to save instructors' time. Gabby Immelman is the founder and CEO of MindJoy, an EdTech startup for STEM teachers to 10x their impact for boundless learning by unleashing student curiosity through the power of AI tutors. With MindJoy, teachers transform lessons they love and know using AI to create engaging digital-first learning experiences for their students. Gabby is a former Reggio educator turned EdTech founder with experience working globally in Africa and the U.S. MindJoy is the third company she has founded. Her first was a stick-on tattoo parlor at the beach that she used to go to for summer vacation as a child. Without further ado, here's our debate between Karin Moret of Critique and Gabby Immelman of MindJoy. Welcome to EdTech Insiders. We have a really exciting episode today. We have two EdTech founders doing a friendly, very friendly debate about some of the pedagogy of online learning. So without further ado, I want to get in and get everybody introduced and start our debate. So let's start with Gabby Immelman, the founder and CEO of MindJoy. Can you tell us a little bit about your EdTech background and what MindJoy does?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Alex. It's great to be here with you both. So MindJoy is a platform for STEM educators to 10x their impact for boundless classroom learning with the power of, AI, specifically AI tutors. And really what we care about is unleashing student curiosity. Pedagogically, that's something we really care about as the world moves into a place where we want to foster, 21st century skills. And, we all talk about the four C's, but curiosity really is the starting point, the sort of flame that we have to kindle to develop young people's motivation and desire to learn. And so that's really what we're trying to do. And we've kind of borrowed this idea, a lot of folks talking in the AI space about 10x engineers or the 100x engineers. We're thinking about how do we build a platform that helps teachers 10x or 100x their impact beyond the traditional four walls of their classrooms that they occupy in physical spaces. And maybe we can reimagine distributing talented teachers' skills beyond just the classrooms they occupy. So that's really what we're about. I'm a former Reggio Emilia educator, and so really played with progressive pedagogies, centered in student-centered learning and project-based learning and forest school and all these amazing things, learning from our environment and making learning visible. So I've had a lot of experience with that. I'm a South African, and I've been fortunate enough to also spend time working in Silicon Valley. So I really had experience working with children from all walks of life, from resource-rich contexts to some of the most under-resourced contexts in the world. One thing I learned is that children everywhere are curious. It doesn't matter where you're born, and talent is really equally distributed, but opportunity isn't. And so I think, you know, that's a big question on everyone's minds around equity and accessibility. So that's something we care about. I often joke, I say that Mindjoy is my third company. I used to have a small business as I was exiting the classroom, doing after-school programs and that kind of thing. But my first business was tattoo parlor at the beach when I was a 12-year-old kid. I used to try and make extra money in the holidays because I'm from a family of entrepreneurs. That was always modeled to me. I was just sharing before we started this podcast that, you know, when I grew up, I came from a family of matriarchs, and my mom and my aunt and both my aunts and my grandmother, they were all entrepreneurs and they all started their own businesses. And so I kind of thought this was normal. I thought this is what you do. So I spent my summer holidays trying to think of businesses and make some extra money. When I went to university, I kind of realized this was not the lived experience of other young women. And so I just kind of realized how much models matter. And yeah, when you come, if I link that all the way back to AI tutors, there's a really interesting thing of thinking about, you know, what is modeled for you is what helps form the way you construct the story of yourself and the opportunities you can access. So I think models matter, and excuse the pun on models. So we can maybe think about the society of models that we're trying to create and, you know, that which we scale. Like, let's hope we only scale good pedagogy.
Yeah, I think it's up to us as a community to scale pedagogy and make sure that we're, as you say, you know, starting with curiosity and augmenting teacher impact and all of these incredibly important aspects of what EdTech does. I'm really excited to, you know, let everybody know more about MindJoy. It's a really cool platform. Karine Maret is the CEO and founder of Critique. Can you tell us about your EdTech story and what you're doing with Critique?
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. Great introduction, Gabby. I like it. I took a few notes. I have a few points in common with you. Yes, so Karine Maret, I co-founded Critique in 2019 with Mohsen Shahini, who built Tarpat in the past. So Critique is an online peer-to-peer learning platform. We created a platform before COVID, so it used to be an experience in person. But now that COVID happened, everyone assumed that Critique was created for online, which is a funny story to share. So a little bit about me before I go too deep in the platform. So my background is French. I'm now bilingual. I immigrated in Canada in 2013. I have an eclectic background, which is what I like about Gabby as well. So I was a designer for Dior, Chanel. I was a project manager for a lot of different startups in the past. I was an accountant. I work in a farm. I did like so many jobs that I cannot list today, but it will be very interesting to talk for the fun of it. And right now, I'm doing my EdD, PhD in Insurance System Technology at Indiana University. This debate is interesting for me to kind of like talk about learning theory as well, but I keep that for the end. Gabby, I like when you make a joke when you say, oh, it's your third company. Well, me too. Guess what? I created a startup before in fashion industry. I had to build clothes, customize, and at that time, I wanted to use AI. But I did not because I didn't have the technology. But I was thinking, okay, what a cool idea if I could create a company where people are so obsessed with like those fashion icons. Oh, I love that clothes. I want to buy. But they don't have the money to buy that same clothes for like thousands of money. Why we can just like give them an alternative using AI. You upload a picture and then you say, I can buy the same cheap clothes to another local shop here or anything from, you know, imported shop. Anyway, that was an idea that I had. I ended up being like a dressmaker back to my first job. And then I stayed for a while there. And then my second company was a smart insole. So I created Fitbit, but in the shoes. So my friends were like PhD students. And then they helped me to design the pattern. And we use a math lab and algorithm to kind of determine like how people walk. And then the application of it was to help senior give an alert to the doctor if the senior fall because there is no weight on the insole. And then also yoga application or sport application. Like I have my Garmin now. I don't know if you have I have this kind of like watch. I think like people are obsessed with data these days. And then of course, the last one is Critique now. You talk about your family, like having a model, Gabby, and then a reel like that. And then one more time, I got something in common with you because my dad was an entrepreneur, my granddad was an entrepreneur, and my grand-grandfamily, like I had a lineage of entrepreneur. And then when it came to me, I was like, oh my God, I have no choice. I want to be an entrepreneur. It's my destiny. And then funny story is my dad does not have son. So for him as well, is like, okay, Karen is going to be the entrepreneur of the family.
Continuing the legacy. So,
yeah, continue the legacy. Well, interesting story. He said, I continue the legacy. You will be the entrepreneur to my company, the next one. So he wanted to take the same businesses. And I said, you know what? I'm going to continue the legacy, but in the area that fits my belief, where I want to stay stable in the environment. And then my mantra was, be the better version of yourself. And then when I had this sentence in mind, I had like, okay, I want to surpass myself. I want to have better skills. I want to do like a lot of different things. I was very passionate about it. So when I came to Canada, my English was very poor. So I went back to school to learn. I had a master's degree in computer science back then in France. But then when I came back to Canada, I had to redo my K-12. Believe me, I have to restart from scratch. Wow. K-12 level. But it was good because it forced me to learn faster. And then I said, okay, I want to continue. What can I do? And I decided to do a bachelor degree in psychology. So when I was doing that, my goal was like, okay, you know what? I want to have A plus everywhere because I got my master with A minus and B plus. And I said, oh, it's not enough. I want to do more. So because I'm an adult now. So I said, oh, and then I was frustrated because my professor did not kind of like give me the feedback that I wanted. And this is how the whole journey of critics started. I wanted to have a system. And then I created online Google Doc to share information. But then no one were doing it because they were afraid of cheating. So I say it's time to create something. So Critic came to mind. So I wanted to focus on developing higher order seeking skills and analyzing and evaluating peer submission in order to learn. So you mentioned, Gabby, the term curiosity. You are focused on learning curiosity. For me, my focus was like critical thinking skills. Like I want to really to just develop that. And then we focus the most on delivering feedback to peers through a feedback and feedback system. And there is some gamification into it. And lastly, just to end my introduction, is there is some AI as well and artificial intelligence that you use to increase the reliability of peer assessment and save instructor time.
You have so many interesting things in common. And one of the things that strikes me, you know, I think you both mentioned that you sort of bridge different kinds of worlds, right? You know, from the tattoo parlor on the beach and, you know, working on a farm to Silicon Valley, you know, work and doing project management and doing fashion startups and all of these really very high tech skills or, you know, smart insoles. And I think that kind of experience gives you both a really wide reach in sort of understanding your learners, the educators you work with, and the technology that can be used to really enhance all of their work. So before we jump into the questions, I just want to do a couple of really quick definitions, because this is something that, you know, I think everybody will benefit by understanding your particular definitions of these terms. Corinne, let me start with you. You mentioned that Critique is a peer assessment platform. Can you just tell us a little bit about peer assessment versus self-assessment and why they're different than sort of traditional assessment?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think it is great to define. So peer assessment is when students take on the role of assessor to evaluate and provide feedback on the quality of work produced by their peers. You know, it can be based on the rubric designed by the instructor. And Critique, we often rely on that to make sure it's very objective, because there's a lot of assignment that could be subjective. But when you have a rubric, it helps. So this method leverage like the diversity of students' perspective, encourage collaborative learning environment, and develop critical thinking skills. And then on the other hand, there is like a self-assessment is where students evaluate their own work, promoting self-reflection, self-regulation, and a deeper sense of ownership of their learning. So maybe what I could share to be more in-depth is like how it works in Critique. So there is three stages. So there is first the creation stage, which is called stage one. This is where the students create and submit their creation. And there's a stage two, which is evaluation stage. And this is where students analyze and evaluate peers' creation and as well as their own. So during that evaluation stage, we can have the peer assessment as well as the self-assessment. And then lastly, the stage three, which is called feedback stage, is where students provide feedback on the evaluation they received. So in this context, we rely on students and algorithm to provide fair grading, and happy to hear more from Gabe as well.
No, that's really helpful. And Gabby, you mentioned AI tutors. We're in this amazing age where this AI tutors are starting to come about. Tell us what you mean when you're talking about AI tutors and how they provide sort of personalized learning or how they might support inquiry-based learning and the sort of curiosity that you're focusing on.
Yeah, sure. So I think it comes to AI tutors, it's not a new idea, right? So the idea of Bloom's Two Sigma problem is something a lot of, you know, I guess everyone in the mastery-based learning world and the platform world, this is something we've thought about for a long time. And Khan Academy is a great example of an incredible mastery-based learning system that seeks to find an answer to Bloom's Two Sigma problem, which I often like to summarize as, you know, the question that poses, how do we make group instruction as effective as one-on-one tutoring? And Corinne, you may say, well, peer assessment is one solution to that problem. Where we play is thinking about basically unbundling expert teachers and asking, how do we create enabling environments that enable, you know, young people to access expert knowledge? And Gen AI, you know, has totally changed the landscape compared to what we used to have in terms of old, you know, machine learning systems or mastery-based or adaptive learning systems, which were incredibly, I'd say, rigid. And compared to what the world of Gen AI or generative tutors possibly present an opportunity for almost this flexible, adaptive experience for students, a student-led experience that is, you know, feels more like talking to an actual person. And so from that perspective, yes, you can have embedded pedagogy or learning outcomes, but the pathways are completely undetermined. And so the opportunity that I think is incredibly exciting in this new world of personalization, it really flips this idea in that young people have to actually start being agents that drive their own learning. And it's kind of meta because as we move, you know, in the AI space, if you start looking at like the agentic models and set, you know, infrastructure for getting agents to do things on behalf of students, I think there's a really interesting fundamental tension that we've never seen before, which is, yeah, we want to outsource things we don't want to do to, you know, AI systems, but learning requires us to do things that we don't want to do to really grow, you know, zone of proximal development, all of that. So there's this really interesting new space. And for us, we care a lot about inquiry-based learning and the Socratic method as one way to not have a system that just gives students answers, but actually engage students and bring them in and get them to think critically. So often we have teachers tell us, oh, our students were so frustrated using MindJoy today. We loved it. They had to think. So, you know, we want it to be a good student experience too, but it is that tension of like, this is hard, but it is also fun and meaningful. And to steal or borrow a term from a great computer scientist and educational technologist, we often talk about hard fun at MindJoy. Seymour Papert was one of the founders of the Media Lab at MIT and was really, you know, a pioneer in terms of computer science for children, creating Logo, but also a great mind in trying to distill how AI systems could work, taking inspiration from how children learn. Fun fact, he was also South African. So he has this idea of hard fun, and that's the pleasure of like almost like the Feynman thing, the pleasure of finding things out, the finding the challenge, enjoyment in the challenge. And so that's something we're trying to inculcate.
Yeah, you don't want to outsource the critical thinking want to make sure that even if you have an agent doing some of the maybe the research or the lookup for you, it doesn't mean that it it should do the thinking for you. Fantastic definitions. So with that, let's jump into our debate questions. And I think this is a very natural segue here. So our first question is, in the context of the type of inquiry-based learning that you just named, Gabby, and you could say Socratic as well, which method is more effective? Is it more effective to engage with AI tutors to ask questions, build curiosity, interact? Or is it more effective to collaborate and evaluate with human peers and work directly with other, you know, real minds? Karine, let me ask you to kick off our debate. How would you answer this question?
Thanks. So this is a great question. Just before I answer your question, I just want to highlight something that Gabby mentioned, which I really appreciate because she does very well on it. She mentioned the Bloom's Two Sigma problem. And that's a well-known phenomenon. It's basically, for people who don't know, is like you tutor one-on-one students with the professors. And then you try to master the learning technique, the skills. And at that long time ago, it was a problem that we could not scale that. So, and then what I appreciate with the technology of Gabby is like, she's now scaling with using AI tutoring, that phenomena. And I think that's very smart of her. So now to answer your question, Alex. So the question about inquiry-based learning. So peer assessment has been around for a while. And then some people didn't have access to our technology, Gabby or mine. So they relied on multiple choice questions. And then it was like, yes and no. And there were no too much inquiry on that because it was like they could not scale the problem-based learning. They had to have a yes-no answer. So now that you have the technology, I think academia is like providing higher education. So critic in that sense is engage with peer assessment, engage learning, and provide quality and consistency in feedback. So we promote critical thinking skills, engagement, skills development, and you know how to effectively address peer learning viability challenge. So I'm going to mention maybe 3 points to answer this question. The first one is like, in Critic, we have a, unlike Gabby, friendly debate. We do not rely on AI. We really emphasize that there is importance in the human element. And the logic behind it is we use the Gardner's theory of multiple intelligence, where human peer provide empathy and emotional intelligence in enhancing soft skills development. So not only we help to develop them the soft skills, but also we kind of like this perspective of human, develop like a sense of responsibility, the sense of belonging. And then we help them to kind of like make connection and provide viewpoint in like the development of their soft skills, like help them, okay, sometime, you know, adult, we have seen a lot of people reacting, oh, why are you saying that? And just like really like be upset. So it's kind of like, it's kind of like close to behavioral therapy where, or behavioral perspective where you say, hey, do not react. Try to step back and then just like, you know, provide feedback. And then so for that, we have various features. You know, we assign evaluation. We have a group activity that I can talk longer or later about that. There's different type of group and live presentation. So now, the second argument that I would like to mention is like there is the depth of understanding. So I don't know how Gabby does with the AI. I suspect that there is like preloaded data where they have to do something. And then, so I'm going to talk about mine and then maybe Gabby can expand. But we do here at Critic focus on learning by teaching. We help students to, you know, develop diverse explanation and viewpoint. It has to be really objective. There's a rubrics and then there's a structure of assessment. So one thing that I want to share is like, you know that you are doing a good job when beyond the classroom, the students share their knowledge. And what happened is in a classroom of like, I think it was about like 1,600 students, one student went on Reddit and then they say, hey, I don't understand the materials, but I don't understand how to learn about that topic. And the student said, hey, I use Critic and I develop, I created a video and I teach my peer using that. This is how I can help you. So basically the students, you know, took one step further, say, I can not only teach my classroom, but I can also go out in the web and then share my knowledge. It's kind of like the value of having a portfolio where you develop your skills and then keep that for your learning. And then the last point that I want to share is adaptability. I don't know how Gabby could adapt to the social learning because AI is not, of course, AI is working as a student. So maybe I'm looking forward to hear from her. But what I can say for me is like this human interaction in the learning environment, you know, are flexible. It's like there is like variability in the response. And then it's also based on the group. So some the group understanding and what kind of issue they want to fix. And then just to be short on the grouping is like, it can be based on preference. It can be based on like talent or different things. So there they can really go in depth in that adapt and then, you know, remove unnecessary feedback. But where adaptability works the best for us is something that's called calibration. So the calibration is like, it's different than a peer evaluation. There's no 3 stages. It's only the second stage where there's an evaluation only. So what happened is like it's determined by the instructor. The instructor, they say, okay, this creation value this grade. And the students need to determine, okay, what is grade that I have to give? And then when you do that, there's 2 purposes for that. One is the algorithm behind the scene will look at the grade given by the students, compare that with the grade given by the instructor, and then the delta will determine the grading power of the students, and that grading power will be used as a score that determines their critical thinking skills. So therefore, it kind of lead to accuracy of grade, and I'm like looking forward for Gabby to challenge me on that, where if I have a high critical thinking skills, then when I grade my peers, my score will count 6 times or more. But if I have low critical thinking skills, I am included in the peer assessment, but not at the expense for other peers to be penalized for my grade. And of course, the second purpose of calibration is it determines the prior knowledge. So the outcome of that calibration, the professor can filter and then we can say, okay, this one understood. That means he has a prior knowledge. So it helps for grouping as well.
What I'm hearing from you, Corinne, is three points about for peer assessment. One, it builds the soft skills and the empathy and the sort of different types of intelligence to have students working with each other. Another is that you can learn by teaching and students can actually, you know, develop their own understanding as well as develop artifacts by creating teaching material for each other. And a third is this idea of adaptability and calibration, where you can actually help students at different levels contribute to each other's, you know, grades in different ways and help people who are maybe behind in critical thinking enhance their critical thinking skills over time. I think I'm paraphrasing that decently, but maybe not, certainly miss some things. But Gabby, let's put it to you. So in the context of inquiry-based learning, which method is more effective, AI tutors or peer assessment?
Well, I think it very much depends on, so if I had to kind of have a critique of peer learning, is that one of your assumptions in the efficacy of peer learning is that the knowledge of the group is required to understand and value and know how to facilitate that kind of experience. And so where you might find that's really, really difficult is for younger students, say in K-12, that have never participated in environments like that, where that's not how your family or your school environment or any of that is set up. You still have very, very traditional, rigid understanding of how knowledge is built. It's very much still that I go to school, I answer questions, I write tests, and there is not a willingness to exchange ideas or put ideas forth. And actually, that is a really, I almost want to say, an advantageous environment to come from, is where you know how to do that, where that's been modeled for you, back to the idea of modeled. So I think AI tutors can serve a tremendous value to even something like peer feedback, is in environments where we don't have that knowledge. That knowledge is not inherent in the teaching style or the pedagogy or the family or community structures, and where we can create things like simulations as an example. So we, for example, our platform builds infrastructure and teachers can build their own tools, their own tutors that are fit for purpose. So fit for their classroom, their lesson goals. They can also learn from expert teachers across the globe who are better than them at building these tools or tutors. And they can use, you know, in some ways a marketplace of tutors, that I can borrow somebody else's tutor. I can fork a copy like you do in programming, fork a copy of a file and modify it and remix it for your purpose. And so we enable that. And what we've done is we've created a lot of tutor templates, sort of research aligned templates based on Ethan Mollock's work, where he's got this great initial study on how AI can be used in the classroom. And so we've actually built tutors aligned to that research that teachers can use and modify for their classrooms. And there you see a variety of really interesting use cases. So AI tutor as a coach. So where tutors are actually help students go through maybe some social emotional learning or soft skills experiences, you know, dealing with a tough time. We've seen teachers do amazing things, like a cyber bully coach, as an example, is something one of our teachers has created. That's actually created a platform for students to share their experiences. And because there's a human in the loop and there's supervision, you know, if there's students that need support, we have a moderation system that helps give teachers insights and help them identify any students that are at risk or need to be supported with something. So that's one way we help with social emotional learning. It also serves as a support to teachers who might not always know how to facilitate those conversations. So that's where something like a simulator is, a simulation, a tutor that helps you simulate an experience. We've seen teachers do all kinds of creative things with simulations, you know, and then you've got just like revision, like tutors or academic coach or like a traditional tutor in that way, help me prepare for an exam, practicing questions, that kind of thing. So again, you know, there's a variety of different use cases depending on your, you know, your dynamics of your classroom and where your classroom is situated and what the knowledge is of the community. But I think what's really exciting is that tutors can embed certain, you know, pedagogies. Like, for example, we default Socratic mode. We've trained thousands of teachers to learn what Socratic method is, you know, because it's in the UX. So like, what is the Socratic method? What does it mean? What does it do? And it's actually then the product becomes a teaching moment. And they're like, wow, that's a really powerful pedagogy. And so we're trying to think about like building product in that way. And I think chatbots are just, say, the first evolution of that envisionment. But yeah, I think it really depends on where your students are, what their level is, and the knowledge of the community. And so I think where AI tutors are incredibly powerful is when you don't have access to that knowledge and where you can distribute knowledge, not just information, but actually even model behaviors or scenarios or practice situations. So I think really the possibilities are endless.
Thanks so much. I think I have no choice to rebut. So I have a few points. I think I'm maybe 3, 4. So the first one, you say, okay, the knowledge of the group, like you kind of like doubt about that. So what I would say is like in the system that we have, let's say if the knowledge is shared, either an evaluation or any feedback, there's always this human perspective where the students can dispute. Say, hey, I want to dispute this fair that this grade that I received or this explanation that I got is not fair. And then they dispute and they basically the professor can intervene and then resolve the dispute. And then he can either remove the grade, say, okay, this is not going to participate, this is not acceptable, or he can edit. And then when the professor edits, what happens is the AI behind the scene will micro-calibrate. So it's kind of the same of the calibration, but within the activity where the professor will say, okay, that does not deserve 5 stars. It will deserve like 3 stars. And the delta will impact the whole pool and adjust the critical thinking skills or the grading score. And then, well, let's say it's fine. What can we do more? What we could do more on top of that is we have something like a collaboration to help with knowledge. So we can add a subject matter expert. And then those can provide feedback. So that's very interesting now, when they provide feedback. And that depends on the policy of the professor. You can always provide feedback before the creation stage is ending or after. And there's also like an evaluation note where the notes can be preloaded. Because you talked to me about like, okay, it's difficult for junior participants. What about those who cannot do it? Well, for those who are skeptical and afraid of it, there is an option where the professor can say, okay, you know what, I'm going to give them the solution. Because a critic is not about finding the right solution. It's about, I would say, okay, here's the solution. Now, what is the thought process for you to get there? And then they have to explain to develop their soft skills. So it's not contagious, to take your words, Gaby. It's not about like, it's very enriching. It enriched the learning. And then we help them, train them to provide a meaningful feedback. And more importantly is it's kind of like anonymous where they feel safe to participate. And then you talk about like the revision. That's very interesting because the goal of peer assessment is like also revisit the first creation. You get the loop of those three stages, creation, evaluation, feedback. And by the end, what do? Well, you do another learning activity or you just say, okay, that's now my final document where I include the feedback received. So now maybe back to you, Gaby, if you don't mind, Alex, asking her questions. Well, I think that in my perspective, there is a limited depth in understanding in like AI tutoring. And let me explain you why. Because I think that the data trained from AI is kind of like predefined information. And then it could be biased and then it's very narrow. And it does not kind of include the contextual nuances that human interaction capture. So I'm saying like, for me, my perspective is a little bit more superficial understanding, and then it does not engage in depth. So what's your thought on it? And also the second thought is, how do you do for teamwork? Do you have anything about like work with teams?
Yeah, sure. I guess there are a couple of things. So I think the limitation of knowledge is a technical one. I think more and more systems are starting to enable tutoring systems to embed corpuses of knowledge and leverage like curated high quality corpuses of knowledge. So often something that we see, so for example, if you have a teacher in one context that teaches IGCSE or the Cambridge curriculum versus the International American curriculum, you can allow for basically selection of curriculums and large corpuses of knowledges to be leveraged by AI systems. So I think that's just a technical one and what we're solving for sure. You know, you can basically leverage our system to also tailor responses, giving the system context awareness of the students. So let me give you an example. If you set up a tutor, you can provide them with a context of your classroom, the students you work with specifically. So you say, these are students that live in a rural place, a rural farm town in South Africa, versus these are New York City children, and I would like you to explain this concept to them. And the system can deal with that and give context-relevant examples. So you can even use show and tell as an example to be like, so an example would be, make sure your explanations include local currency in the way you prompt a tutor. You can make sure that, like, it's astounding sometimes what the references are. So how much awareness actually, if focused in the right way, and if you provide with the system with the right context, how much personalization and context relevance you can actually create for learners. And the ability to deal with ambiguity, I would say, is another really interesting thing. So if a student or a learner says, I do not know what that means, an example would be maths, giving a maths problem with like, all right, so the system says candy, like your candy. Say you wrote a terrible prompt and your tutor really, really struggled with anything. So one of the amazing things is you just need to kind of know to go, I don't know what that means. I don't know what a candy is. And they'll be like, oh, it means chocolates. And you'll be like, I don't have chocolate. Like, I don't really get chocolates where I'm from. Like, well, chocolate's not really a big thing where I'm from. And then you say, all right, well, like, what do you have a lot of? Like, that's a treat. And then you might say, oh, we have mangoes, lots of mangoes, the fruit. And I was like, okay, great. So let's go with mangoes then. If you had a mango and you cut it in half, like blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden, that level of ambiguity is very, very different form of personalization that is possible versus an adaptive learning system, as an example. So that would be sort of my rebuttal in terms of personalization. I think like what we try and do is we obviously try and engineer away bias and safety and harm. And we're looking at all of those kinds of things because we want to use AI for good. And so that's where human in the loop matters a lot. But I also think that one thing we care a lot about is talking about making sure, and then this is maybe an African sentiment, is a lot of people are like, oh, it's biased, don't use the systems. Well, if you are not a customer, then your values and the things that you stand for will not be represented. And so participating, being an active consumer and voting with your dollar and being represented with your dollar matters. That's something we advocate for in a big way, which is empower yourself to know. AI literacy is one part of it, but also empower yourself to be a user that gets represented fundamentally. And so that's something we think a lot about when we talk to teachers. And, you know, we care a lot about also just having these conversations and creating forums for teachers and folks from all over the world.
Thanks for answering. I think like I like the fact that, you know, you define that how it's not as superficial as it should be. But maybe the second part of my question was about, like, do you have anything to work with team? I think like when, because we do emphasize with like teamwork or things like that. At Critique, we have two type of groupings, the between groups or within groups. This is how we engage teams in our platform. So let me start with the between groups. So between groups is this interaction between the evaluation stage. So as I told you before, there's three stages in Critique: creation, evaluation, and feedback. So in the creation stage, each group will submit one creation. Group A submit one, group B submit one. And then during the evaluation, the group A will evaluate group B. And then the same for the group B will evaluate group A. So this is basically how it works. Now, Professor told us, like, okay, the traditional way of doing group work, when there is one submission, you know, you don't know if the other participant participate. So with that type of group between groups, you know that it's efficient because during the evaluation stage, they will participate and they will need to think critically. Despite having one creation submitted for the group, everyone will participate during this activity, peer activity of between groups. Some professors said, sure, I like that, but I would like to have everyone participate in the creation stage. So that's how we created the next activity type later on, which is called within group. So within group is everyone in a group, group A, everyone in group A will submit one creation. Everyone in group B will submit one creation and they will evaluate each other's. So there is no interaction between groups. The group is predefined by the professor or predefined via the algorithm. So how to use the algorithm for that? So we have the calibration features, where the professor uploads a tree creation. The score is given by the professor. And then the students need to evaluate those creations. And the closest their score is to the professor, the higher the critical thinking skills will be, the score. And then from the result of that activity, then the professor can rank those students And then from the ranking, they can say, okay, I will group the students with the same level. So I'll take the top 10%, and then I group them, and then so on and so forth. Or I will take the, I will have to have a mixed match of levels. So I will take some students from the beginning and then some students for the at the end. And then, so it depends on the philosophy of the professors. But what the point is, in Qt'c, we can identify prior knowledge via these calibration features. And then now we can group students based on their interests, experience, knowledge, competency. And that's basically the value that we are giving it here. So another thing that we could do as well that some professors I've seen had done is they use personality tests to group students. And then from the personality test, they will know who can be matched with another. So that could be part of the learning activity, where the first critical learning activity or a survey of the personality test need to be completed. And then they need to reflect on it. And then from that activity, then the professor can group the next students into the a very insightful collaborative project. And then one thing that we should not forget is we are a peer assessment platform, but also there is a self-evaluation as well in those grouping features. So this is where it works. So I would like to learn more from you as well.
Like, I feel that AI tutoring is missing this element of like inquiry, because we are in the topic of inquiry based.
Yeah.
So do you have...
Yeah, so again, like, so simulations, for example, are game-based or team-based, often team-based experiences. So you might have one tutor facilitating group work or conversation. Another modality that we use a lot of is like something like encouraging good pedagogy. So something like a very simple activity, scaling an idea like think, pair, share, as an example. So that is not about just one-on-one with the tutor. That is about work with the tutor, then pair up with your teammate, work with your teammate, then participate in a big classroom discussion. And so what you often see, and a lot of the feedback we get, is teachers saying, wow, this is enabling students whose voices I never previously heard to participate in conversations, because now they had a chance to practice the idea or work it. So, you know, those are ideas where you can scale, where you have, you facilitate peer work and group work and teamwork. And then just basically multiplayer chat is on the roadmap.
I like what you're saying. And I think I want to emphasize something, like, I like you mentioned previously and now, the power of like active learning and, you know, wow, I never heard about that before. So, and also thanks for precising like how those dynamic works, because it helped me to understand the value of your platform. So what I would like to add here is we do also value the context of like a relevant example. Like one thing we have is like multi-topic. So we use like kind of like in the creation stage an ability of multi-topic. So the students can be assigned to a topic that they like to debate or to discuss, or it can be like random. And then basically what happens is like the professor will use the same learning activity, the same rubrics. And it's kind of like almost like the like competency-based education, where the application of the learning in multi-topic can be either a lower level and a higher level. And then those who have the prior knowledge can apply in depth their learning. And those who are just beginner can just still build on their knowledge, as well as what you mentioned before. You know, you said different topic, completely irrelevant. So you can say the same topic, but one in France, one in America. We could also do that as well. And then, maybe it's getting too long for that topic, but I still have like, we do, like you mentioned the term ambiguity. And I think that's a very nice term to highlight, because in Qt'c, we do have like a structure and assessment, like to remove those ambiguity. So thanks, Alex, for letting me like asking those questions.
Fascinating. So let me just put some of the things that we've heard. It's a really interesting debate. And let me paraphrase just for a second, just because there's a lot going on here. So Gabby, you mentioned that you have simulations that AI tutors can actually model different pedagogies like Socratic method and teach teachers to do that, but that it also the tutors can model thinking to students who may not have the prior knowledge or the context to be able to perform peer assessment effectively. That was part of your points. And then Corinne, you're saying that AI can contain bias, maybe that it doesn't have deep enough knowledge to provide context. And Gabby, you're, on the other hand, you're saying that AI tutors can actually be prompted and designed to include context, or through interaction, it can learn the context of the student environment, like the mango chocolate example. And then lastly, we've talked a little bit about group work, which I think is really a very important part of this debate, right? Which is, you know, peer assessment is sort of designed to be social. It's designed to be group oriented and can work with lots of different types of assignments, including group assignments. And is that yet true for AI tutoring? And I think, Gabby, you're saying it is beginning to be true. There are definitely some ways that group work can work with AI tutors as facilitators for group work. You already have social pieces that way. You model think, pair, share and other social pedagogies, and that this sort of multiplayer mode type of thing is coming. And then you're saying, Curried, as well, that this adaptivity, the idea of being able to adapt with these sort of multi-topic type of work, is also a really core focus of peer assessment, that you can use the human in the loop and the teacher prompt, as well as the sort of systems understanding, to be able to tailor and personalize the same way that AI tutors sort of naturally personalize. A lot of really interesting things going on here. So I want to ask about another incredibly important aspect. Education technology is all about scalable education. That is a huge part of what it does. So in terms of peer assessment versus AI tutoring, which type of platform offers greater scalability and accessibility to diverse learning communities that may not have access to education in this way? Is it AI tutoring systems that are 24/7, that are accessible, you know, to students on their devices and global? Is it peer assessment platforms that are able to expand the reach of any educator to include a huge variety of different evaluators and people who give feedback, including on systems like Reddit, like you mentioned, Karine? Gabby, let me start with you. Which platform offers greater scalability and accessibility?
So I think there's room for both. And that's maybe a little bit of a cop-out as an answer. And I guess it just depends on how one builds one's platform and that kind of thing. One thing we spoke about at the beginning was, you know, social learning. And I think one of the most interesting phenomena fundamentally is that learning is basically a social phenomenon. We learn way more from each other than we do like sitting, rote, studying. We're just actually constantly learning. And I think one of the things we think a lot about at MindJoy is, and we often try and fight the idea of like traditional tutoring in many ways, is the thing that we actually care a lot about is the importance of motivation. And I think social learning and connection is so, so important in today's age, right? It's essential. Like, young people are lonelier than they ever were before. There are all these kinds of questions. And I think the value of shared experience has increased, and the importance of shared experience has increased. And so I don't think classrooms, I think if the pandemic taught us anything, is that classrooms are not going to go away for most of the world. Yes, micro schools are a growing trend, and there are all these alternative pathways. But for most of the world, if you look at the African continent, most of Africa is going to still be educated in traditional school settings. And those are fundamentally social learning experiences. The traditional classroom is a social, is an opportunity to cultivate social learning. But very few classrooms operate that way. And so when I talk about scaling good pedagogy, we care about changing the way those classrooms work. We want to transform school from the inside out, because kids getting together at school is a great thing. There's wisdom in the old, but there's also a need to do things differently. And so I think the scalability of AI platforms present a tremendous opportunity in facilitating that change. And I think it's going to happen much slower than we think, but I think it's going to be more drastic than we anticipate. So I think that's maybe a short answer to your question. I think the other thing that we think a lot about is this idea that resource-rich contexts will always have master teachers. I don't think teachers are going away. Great teachers will serve at the top institutions. That's sort of the law of excellence. Like, the top teachers go to the top. But then the question becomes, the deficit is really in rural classrooms, classrooms in poverty, classrooms where there's a lack of resources. And what do we do in those spaces? Because we don't have enough people. You know, we have, by 2030, we'll have a 26 million teacher shortfall. And I always say, like, oh, it's so interesting that 26 million software engineers. So if you're teaching things like STEM skills, scaling, you know, engineers, getting engineers to give all their time, and technical students and computer science grads, is not the way to scale STEM skills. And so which that's specifically what we care about. So we ask, like, how do you take a non-technical teacher and empower them to teach technical subjects like science and coding and mathematics? And we think, you know, we did some really early interesting collaborations with a company like Replit in the early days with mobile coding. And what was then the start of, we were part of the ChatGPT beta as GPT-3's beta, and looking at how do we take a difficult subject like teaching coding and how do we empower non-technical folks to teach it in environments where you don't have Chromebooks, but maybe mobile-first environments. And what was really exciting to see is, oh, how all of a sudden, if you know how the skills you need to teach is asking questions, being able to follow up with your questions, this idea of curiosity. But if you know how to do that, you can guide your curiosity anywhere. And so that is the tremendously excited thing for me about the scalability and accessibility is being able to take expert knowledge. Basically, the cost of intelligence, right, is going down. And we're able to scale it to places in the world where people wouldn't be able to access that kind of knowledge. And that is an incredibly exciting opportunity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think for me, it's like, you know, we are here to transform the school, the education. And I like that Gabby mentioned the role of the teacher. So for us, to answer these scalability questions, the role of the teacher is important because we want to kind of like empower the students to take ownership of their learning. It's like the same thing Gabby said, like we want them to be curious, we want to be owned, and then we want to help to be ensure that they're the client at the end of the day. They pay their education, right? So just like own it and then develop the skills that you need for the workplace. So the role of the teacher here is about not being anymore teaching, but on top of teaching, they need to be a facilitator where they facilitate knowledge between students. And then they basically observe them. And then, of course, guide them. Like I like this word as well, like giving them feedback, correcting the direction. They are really the guide. And then I like the word that Gabby said, like in terms of the lack of resources or the lack, I would say I will add on top of it, like the gap of knowledge between students, like how, because at the end of the day, we want to help all students to learn together. And it's kind of like quite difficult if you are not in the world of scaling, right? Like how do you scale mass amount of students, like let's say 1,000? So to answer this example, I will just give an example from Africa, as Gabby is from there. So we have a client from Africa, and then this university has like 7,000 of African engineer students. And then basically the role is to teach tech subject, the same way that you mentioned earlier, Gabby. And then basically we help them to develop a good communication skills on the tech subject. And then they are aiming to join the company that you have worked before, Gabby, like something located in a Silicon Valley. So that's the aim. And then we are then there to engage them and then enhance their communication skills. So here in terms of scaling that process, we help them to give and receive authentic feedback among those 7,000 students. And then we make sure that there is an anonymous part of it where they will be free to participate. And I have another research, which is like a professor, Valerie Wellborn from Virginia Tech. So basically, she worked also with tech students. And then before, when she was in class, the minority, such as female engineer, didn't want to participate because they were intimidated. And then so what happened is like with critics, she found out that not only they participated, but also they have like a very strong communication skills in providing feedback. So that was a great discovery. And then they became more engaged. And this is how she scaled like authentic feedback using Kelly. And another example will be David Wong from University of Waterloo. He also like conducted the research. And then he also highlighted like how the female participated as being a great leader and then removed the lack of confidence in those things. And then lastly, when you talk about scaling, I would like to say that it's important to scale also for students with a disability. So we are compliant to the like Web Content Accessibility Guideline, WCAG. And also we do a late submission for students with disability. So they can submit late, but they have to justify or write something down for the professor, accessible to professor only. And then now the professor, instead of checking email and things like that, and now we can scale that process among them. And then something really on top of it is we have a live presentation where one student can present in a classroom. That presentation is recorded, uploaded in Credit. And now students who cannot just like see or are not in class or things like that, they have access. And then they can just do asynchronous feedback. And then basically that helps to adapt to a variety of mediums. So we are supported. Like, we are trying to do as much as possible, supporting the principle of universal design for learning, UDL, to support diverse learning, different type of material, text, video, image, live presentation like today.
I guess in our world, the advent of multimodal is really, really exciting. Just also to increase interactivity from not just, you know, you can work with various different types of inputs. So visual, audio, text in, text out, voice in, voice out. Really, really exciting space. So we also build with all the accessibility web standards in place. I'm really trying to leverage. For us, we build mobile first, just because we're bullish on mobile. And, you know, it's just really interesting to see how second nature mobile is to young people. You know, I think sometimes it's hard to empathize if you're even a millennial with young people growing up today. But like, mobile phones are just really an extension of them. And you think, oh, you couldn't possibly type on a phone like that. And yet it's second nature. And so it's a different form of adaptability, but our own adaptability is actually sometimes quite surprising and I think counterintuitive too.
Yeah. Lots of great points here. Again, just a quick synopsis, because I think there's such interesting stuff going by and lots of points being delivered in a really short period. So Gabby, you started by talking about motivation and how having that shared experience is really, really key to getting people excited and motivated to build on their curiosity and learn. And specifically sort of honed in on how resource poor environments that don't necessarily have the highest quality teaching can use AI tutors to enhance their teaching without needing a lot of additional context. So that was a sort of vote for the scalability of AI. You also mentioned mobile first as a way to provide access and this multimodal approach that parallels what is being happening in UDL with peer assessment. You both mentioned sort of the value of elevating student voices that aren't always heard in the classroom. And I think both peer assessment and AI tutoring can allow people to engage students who may not otherwise have been able to. Corinne, you talked about the teacher role, which I think was really interesting, that, you know, in a peer assessment environment, the teacher still has a very strong role in sort of structuring how the facilitation takes place, which may or may not be as true in an AI environment. I think it remains to be seen. You also talked about the gap of knowledge and how, you know, in environments where there is resource poor education, peer assessment can actually support that kind of environment by creating a framework where students can teach each other and build on each other's knowledge, including in anonymous environments. You both talked about disability a little bit and the value of STEM and how difficult it is to get technical educators into classrooms, but how both of your methods can supplement and support that type of teaching. Very good points on both sides, and I think a lot of cases to be made for the scalability and accessibility for both technologies.
So we're busy with pilots, which is kind of interesting. And our theory on impact from just a teaching and learning perspective on curiosity specifically is based on question handling. And so one of the things we're seeing is AI tutors provide teachers with the ability to deal with more questions in the same period of time as that they wouldn't be able to. So quite simply, like a teacher who can answer on average, and like this is sort of an average thing, which is like, teachers on average ask about 2 questions a minute. So what's interesting is they ask 2 questions and the habit that is built is students answering. And so what we're seeing is 2 things. One, and maybe 10 questions, 10, 20 questions, if you have a very active teacher who is not just doing a direct instruction type scripted lesson, but is facilitating conversation, is able to answer 10, 15 questions. And so what we're now seeing is that, say, for example, in, say, even a traditional classroom where you use sort of an AI-assisted think-pair-share model, all of a sudden you have 30 students, 40 students, in some cases 60 students in a class, and one teacher have the ability to ask 3,000 questions in the same amount of time. And what is interesting is that they're not just, especially with a Socratic method, for example, as a pedagogy, they're not just answering questions, they're also asking questions. And so from the skills development, you're seeing the development of asking and answering questions, which we think is really, really exciting in terms of inquiry-based learning and developing young children's capacity. But I think that's something really, really exciting in terms of what we mean to be a 100x teacher.
Yeah, and then I guess the last thing that, you know, I like that Gabby mentioned about piloting all those things. We do also pilot things. And then thing that I didn't mention during this debate is I only talk about the calibration and micro calibration, but we have more things. Like we have AI-generated content where the professor can upload the syllabus. And from that syllabus, the whole course can be created, the learning activity, the rubrics. And then for the student side, when the students sometimes say, okay, you know, what about if the students use AI and generate content? So we have like a AI plagiarism detection where the professor can click the button and then see what's the likelihood of that detection. But I'm not going to debate here. I know. Okay, maybe keep that for another time because we don't have time. But there is some flaws with
AI
detection.
A lot of flaws.
But I think it's a good debate maybe for another time. What I would like to say back to now, the purpose for me of this debate, as I'm a student and a doctoral student at Indiana University, I would like to end this debate that we, throughout the journey of like an hour about, we talk about constructivism, collaborative, integrative, reflective, inquiry-based learning. And all of those are valid in terms of learning. There's no one true way of doing it. And I think all educators need to find out, like, okay, for that application, I think Gabby's technology works. For that application, Karine's technology works. And also other technology, of course, out there. There's a multiple of them. So I just want to share one thing here about how we build on learning theory to create a layer of learning, which is not a single theory alone that could be accomplished. So I would like to start by saying the structural feedback mechanism act in critique as a reinforcement for learning behavior. So the calibration activity, the grading power adjustment, the feedback mechanism, it kind of like reward because there's a gamification there where, you know, you want to gain points. So which is based on the theory of behaviorism. And then there's another layer on top of that, which is like the feedback mechanism to extract higher order learning, like critical thinking skills, problem solving skills, and other skills, which is related to like the cognitivism, where we want to enhance the cognition of the students. And then I have been searching for a long time, but I think AI is not proven yet, but does AI enhance cognition or not? And I haven't found the answer yet. So I still need to do another debate as well on that. But for now, I let it as is. It's like we, of course, know it's proven that students among each other, when they enhance their knowledge base and critical thinking skills, they enhance their cognition to resolve problems because you don't give them the answer. They go through the journey. And then,
sorry, I was just wanting to check. Are you saying cognition?
Cognitivism, the cognitivism theory. Yeah. So I just talk about behaviorism. Now I just talk about cognitivism. And then on top of that, there's two more layers, which is the layer of constructivism, that where the feedback mechanism and critique are paired to construct knowledge. The constructivism process helps to further construction of knowledge among each other. And then it's a well-rounded, a holistic approach to learning that has been proven in the literature because it's not a new concept. And then the last one, of course, is like to, you know, we talk together about it as well, you know, the importance of social cultural approach. And then on that one, I want to talk about some theory about like Bandura, Pirlo theory, critical pedagogy, and then Vygotsky, how we just like provide different viewpoint and scaffolding activity in order to learn with each other. And then there's this kind of like in-depth access to viewpoint these days that we didn't have in the past. And that transformed the oppressive social structure. And I think this is what I would like to end this debate is like education now is like a layered approaches in order to bring diversity into technology. And then without me or Gabby to provide technology, I think it will be impossible for educators to reach the potential that they want to. So I encourage, I guess, all educators to learn about the technology and then just find out what's the best fit for them.
Amazing. I know we're coming on time, so I want to give each of you a moment to, you know, just give a little bit of a closing statement about your approach to pedagogy. I think just one quick point before that, you know, your phrase earlier, Gabby, about the cost of intelligence is going down really stuck with me. And I feel so relevant to both of your approaches, right? It obviously is relevant to AI in that the cost of intelligence, virtually created intelligence, has gone down so much that you can introduce it in all sorts of frameworks and contexts and technologies. I think it's also relevant to peer assessment and peer learning, because the ability to communicate on the kind of scale, the asynchronous communication, synchronous communication, mobile communication, means that access to other human intelligence has also gone down. That you see that in things like Reddit and Stack Overflow and all sorts of environments like that. So I think that is just something that stood out to me as a really interesting shared approach. You obviously share a lot of ideas here. So let's go into our final statements. Gabby, let me start with you. We're almost at time. Just in a minute or so, tell us about your sort of total thinking about why AI tutors provide a really strong pedagogy for learners.
So like if you've embedded on, like just to go to some thoughts that Kieran was sharing, and something we care about is constructivism. So Papert's work, Vygotsky, Bandura, social learning theory. And I also really care a lot about, you know, Ryan Dessey's work on self-determination. I think that for me is one of the things we care most about is how do you help young people maintain their sense of motivation in a world where human and machine output is indistinguishable? And I think that's something we are only just starting to grapple with. Like, what is that going to do to the psyche of humans? How do we build motivation? How do we find connection? How do we stay motivated to build mastery and skill and pursue meaningful experiences and meaning making? How do we practice agency? So in terms of the pedagogy that underpins what we're trying to engender and build and cultivate is fundamentally to support young people. Like at the end of the day, our end user is young people, and we see teachers as a fundamental ally in supporting developing young people's sense of motivation and their desire to want to learn in the same way as they want to use TikTok. And so I think, you know, one of the questions we ask ourselves is how do you engineer communities that value learning, and that learning is a human endeavor? And maybe learning is also a machine endeavor, but expression and creativity is a really interesting one to explore. So that's a whole other debate, is what is human creativity versus machine creativity? But I think we often confuse the idea of creativity and self-expression. And so I think what's really important as a society is how do we wield tools like AI to help us express ourselves and find connection and solve problems, but not to confuse that with this idea of creativity, which is the pursuit of intelligence that's trying to come up with novel ways of solving problems. Because I think we might trip ourselves up then. So yeah, those would be my closing thoughts. We want to just help create communities that do learn together. And that's a social experience.
Yeah, I could not agree more with Gabby saying. And then to support her argument, I want to say a quote from Ken Robinson, which I really love. This person, I rest in peace for him, for what he had accomplished for education. He said, curiosity is an engine of achievement. Which goes to now my final thought to answer your question, Alex, is like, KEDEC is about like asking people, what do you want for your students post-graduation? And I think it's about ultimately is to make learning engaging, effective, and efficient during the courses of like doing your course. And then make that as much as possible real to the work experience. For example, right now, I'm doing my PhD in education, and one of my assignments is, hey, debate with your classmate. Well, I said, okay, I'm not going to debate with someone as a fake debate. Why not doing some intelligent conversation with Gabby? And then I had so much fun today. And then now we can just say, hey, this is Alex giving a live podcast for the audience, and people are learning from it. So ultimately, I would say that final statement is, let's make sure that our students get smarter post-graduation and use as much as possible their time to build portfolio, to display, to showcase, because we want them to get a job. We want them to just like really say, hey, in that university, I built this kind of like learning, and then this is what I can display. And recently, just as to illustrate, 2 weeks ago, I went to the UFT. They asked me, okay, do you want to volunteer to present? I say, why not? So I present what KEDEC is about. It's a class of engineers, and then they have to basically do a project on how to enhance design in, you know, product. They moved the platform, and I also share the history. And now they are working on it right now live. And then they have to present to me in 2-3 weeks. And then when they will present to me, I told them the winner will get a letter from us for being like, do awesome job. So it's kind of like giving like the great motivation, as you really emphasize, Gaby. And then I will do it. Like, I really want to help them to just like get a job and happy to participate in more universities classroom as well.
Yeah. Fascinating, really interesting debate about two incredibly important pedagogical approaches, AI tutoring and peer assessment. I really appreciate you both being here. And, you know, listeners may notice there were a lot of theories, learning theories dropped during this debate. We heard about behaviorism, cognitivism, constructivism, Ryan Odesta, self-determination. Well, yeah, all your social, cultural, amazing stuff, constructivism. So we will put a set of links in the show notes for this episode of, you know, definitions of some of these theories, as well as some papers you might want to look into if you want to dive deeper into any of these pedagogical theories that these two amazing founders are using in their work. I want to thank both of you, Karine Maret from Critique and Gaby Immelman from MindJoy. Thanks so much for being here with us on EdTech Insiders.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of EdTech Insiders. If you like the podcast, remember to rate it and share it with others in the EdTech community. For those who want even more EdTech Insider, subscribe to the free EdTech Insiders newsletter on Substack. This season of EdTech Insiders is brought to you by Tuck Advisors. Tuck Advisors is a trusted name in education M&A, founded by serial entrepreneurs with over 25 years of experience starting, investing in, and selling companies. Tuck Advisors believes founders deserve M&A advisors who work as hard as they do.